Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
It's time to rebrand the image of our country across the globe. So to us, we are sending a message out there that Sierra Leone is here as a country that respects human rights, and we do everything possible to protect the rights of its citizens.
Sierra Leone abolishes the death penalty.
We, the Cameroonian women, spread the women's call for peace to all the corners of the world, to the hallways of institutions such as the African Union, the European Union, and the United Nations.
About 1,000 Cameroonian women activists plan to meet this week at a three-day national peace convention to discuss solutions to the ongoing conflict.
People are questioning, why are we not free to choose even different types of vaccines that people would want to get? Why only this one? Maybe that's the expression of many people whom I happen to talk to.
And Tanzania's government imposes a ban on public gatherings to combat the spread of the coronavirus. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Sierra Leonean President Julius Maada Bio says he plans to sign into law a bill that abolishes the death penalty. In a unanimous vote Friday, parliamentarians agreed to repeal the law. The president says he has kept a core campaign pledge, which he says includes abolishing the death penalty and ensuring the preservation of life. The move has been welcomed as a positive development by human rights defenders in the West African country. The new law will nullify a constitutional provision that enables the court to sentence to death convicted offenders who commit crimes including treason, mutiny, murder, and aggravated robbery. Umaru Napoleon Koroma is the Sierra Leonean Deputy Minister of Justice. He tells me that the death penalty will be replaced by life imprisonment.
The House of Parliament unanimously agreed to abolish the death penalty by enacting a new act. The death penalty will now be removed from the TGMI legislations, which are the Offences Against a Person's Act of 1861, the Larceny Act of 1916, and the State Treason and Other Offences Act of 1963. Essentially, what does that mean? The courts will no longer have as punishment the death penalty for offenses committed under the provisions of our law. So essentially, we're done with the death penalty in Sierra Leone. So it's a victory for all Sierra Leoneans. There's been a very, very long drawn campaign. The argument has been very much fierce between those who believe in the abolishment of the death penalty and those who believe that it should be maintained to serve as some kind of deterrent.
What has been the reaction of Sierra Leoneans following the abolishing of this death penalty?
As expected, it has been a kind of mixed reactions from the populace, but I'm certain that as a result of the advocacy done by several human rights groups in the Republic of Sierra Leone, people generally have come to accept the reality. The fact that for the last 20 years, since 1998, there has been a moratorium on the death penalty. And finally today, the Attorney General said that that was not enough, that we needed to remove it from our law books.
So where do Sierra Leone or Sierra Leoneans go from here?
In my opinion, Peter, this is a great victory for the country. We have joined the international community. I understand Sierra Leone is now the 110th country that has abolished the death penalty, and I'm certain more will follow suit. And it's a victory for a country, and we are grateful and happy that the president came on a platform that he believes in the preservation of life, and he has been able to live up to his commitment to the people of this country to say These laws that we have maintained in our law books for so many years, we should now replace them. We should now find an alternative to them so that we can be able to promote the preservation of life theory, which many people believe is a way to go.
Well, Umaru, proponents of the death penalty are of the opinion that the death penalty is the only measure or law that serves as a deterrent. So what replaces the death penalty?
Thank you, Peter. That's been the argument since the debate over the abolishment or the non-abolishment of the death penalty started. But in my opinion, death penalty has never served as a deterrent to the offenses for which they have been applied. We have never had a situation where people have stopped committing the offenses because they know that the punishment for it is death by hanging. So as a first point, I disagree with that particular proposition. So today, basically, what we had proposed from the Office of the Attorney General was to replace the death penalty with a mandatory life in prison. It went to Parliament. Parliament decided to adjourn it and asked the public to give certain opinion on the issue. So Parliament received those opinion, and today, during the debate, a couple of issues were raised, and now we're replacing it now with a sentence not less than 30 years. And the discretion will be for the judge, depending on the circumstances of the case, to sentence the person beyond that or more. And we're also going to look at other legislations that will be amending to fit in with what Parliament has agreed on today.
With this move, what message does your government want to send to the people of Sierra Leone?
Well, we believe as a government that it's time for Sierra Leone to move forward. It's time for Sierra Leone to join other progressive nations in the world. It's time for Sierra Leone to be in line with international best practices. It's time to rebrand the image of our country across the globe. So to us, we are sending a message out there that Sierra Leone is here as a country that respects human rights, and we do everything possible to protect the rights of its citizens.
Umaru Napoleon Koroma is the Sierra Leonean Deputy Minister of Justice. He spoke with me from the capital, Freetown. In Ghana, leaders of the Opposition Convention's People's Party, or CPP, say they are implementing new strategic measures to win the country's next election. But skeptics say the CPP, which was first led by independence leader Dr. Kwame Nkrumah, is a pale shadow of itself. Analysts say the political landscape is now dominated by the governing New Patriotic Party, or NPP, and the main opposition National Democratic Congress, or NDC. They also say it will be difficult for any other party to pose a significant challenge to the two main parties. But Nana Akosua-Frimpomaa, chairperson and leader of the CPP, sharply disagrees with the assessment. She tells me the Ghanaians have been disappointed with the performance of the two major parties, arguing that voters are determined to choose the CPP to form the next government.
From August, when we took over power, we've done nothing but trying to build the base at the polling station and electoral area. And for me, that is what we have to do, and that is what we intend doing. And most importantly, in building the base, we need to give a message to the frustrated youth of today. The current youth of today are looking for answers. The projects that the First Republic did, which is the CPP under the leadership of Osagyefo, Dr. Kwame Nkrumah, from independence all down to the 400 factories, the major infrastructure programs that were put in place, clearly the young people are beginning to realize that where Ghana is headed towards, it's not the best for them. So we are at a clear position today to be able to harness the energy, engage the youth, and give them the best alternative. And that's exactly what we are poised to do with the current leadership.
Well, Madam Frimpomaa, a lot of Ghanaian youths that I have spoken with are of the view that the CPP is of old people, and that the party seemed to rely heavily on its past glory as the party that led Ghana to independence. What
will you do to attract the youth? Because without the youth, the party will not achieve its aim of being the alternative to the two major parties in Ghana at the moment.
The Ghanaian youth used to think that way. Currently, it's different. Even if you look at our current leadership, you realize that from the national organizer to the women's organizer, the youth organizer, the treasurer, they are in their early 30s. So things are changing. What is important now is the message. The Ghanaian today is beginning to see that these two parties have not helped them. The situation is not the best for the country. So what is happening is that we have a clear message for the youth. What we are saying is that if we took over power today, tomorrow morning would have at least 1 million youth who will be out there ready for us to support them in funding so that they can be creative, innovative, and be able to use their entrepreneurial spirit to build this country again.
So, Nana, why should Ghanaians trust the CPP to deliver on the promises that you are making to them, particularly when the CPP and its political fortunes seem to be dwindling from 1992 after Ghana re-embraced democratic rule?
We seem to be dwindling because we didn't have the base. And all the enthusiasm and all the people that have tried to rebuild the party have left the base itself. And that is what we have decided to do this time. In addition, the country and the situation is ripe today for a new era. The Ghanaian wants the country fixed. The current government does not have the answers.
Moving forward, what should be the expectations of Ghanaians regarding the apparent resurgence of CPP in the Ghanaian political atmosphere?
Moving forward, the Ghanaians should expect much more of us. We are not going to just be jumping all over the place just as the other parties do. But we are going to make sure that we affect the lives of the youth of today. And we are going to make sure that issues that concern the people of Ghana, we would represent and address it in their interest as long as we know of it. Because if we cannot connect to the people, if they can't see us as people that care, then it will be difficult for them to see us as an alternative. It is not just about promises, but it's about doing the very things that we believe in, which is things that borders on the welfare and the development of the people.
Nana Akosua-Frimpoma is chairperson and leader of the Convention People's Party, or CPP. She spoke with me from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. In Cameroon, about 1,000 women activists and stakeholders are scheduled to meet this week at a 3-day National Peace Convention to discuss solutions to the ongoing conflict in the Central African country. Organizers say the conference begins from July 29 to 31 in the capital, Yaoundé. Human rights groups say the violence between Anglophone rebels and the military has left over 3,000 people dead and over 1 million displaced from their homes. The 3-day meeting will be the first Women's National Peace Convention aimed at finding ways of resolving the conflict. Local media reports that both sides have so far refused to accept a ceasefire that will lead to dialogue as part of an effort to end the fighting. For more on the upcoming First National Women's Peace Convention, I reach Esther Omam Njomo, Executive Director of the NGO called Women's Empowerment.
We have been carrying out initiatives in individualistic ways. Each group, each coalition, each platform or networks doing their thing, their own way, in their own little corner, you know, without meaningful impact. So this time we found agency and we've decided to do it differently. We have decided to come together. We have seen the need to concert efforts, to come together, in order to, first of all, be happy that we are together under one same platform, which is the Cameroon Women Peace Convention, facilitated by the Friedrich Herbert Foundation, and also to make a call for peace, because every day that passes by, people are dying.
This is the first time Cameroonian women will be coming jointly from all across the country to demand and find ways to resolve this ongoing conflict. How different is this? And what is your anticipation of how things will go?
The difference is clear, because this time around, it is not only us, but it is a wide range of key stakeholders who will come to hear about our story, the story of untold pains and sufferings which women have been carrying on their shoulders, in their hearts, for 5 years, 4 years, or 5 years going, be it in the Northwest, Southwest, the North, or the East. That is the difference. The difference is that we are coming knowing that we'll be talking about equality, development, and peace, which are the symbol of women. We will be coming to pave the way forward by devising strategies, analyzing, proposing, suggesting strategies, you know, which will help in advancing the cause for justice and peace in our country. That is the difference.
Why do you think that this time around the two sides will listen to the call by about 1,000 women calling for a cessation of hostilities, for dialogue, and to end this conflict?
Anyone who does not hearken to the voice of a woman is not worthy of the calling of the name man. I don't think that when we come up with resolutions or recommendations, when we make the call for peace, either of both parties will be indifferent to our call. I don't think so. I think that these parties to the conflict have been looking for ways, seeking pathways to resolve this dirty war, but they've not known how to go about it. But let me tell you, the strength of a woman lies in unity. When women decide to tie the bundle, as we see in Africa, when they decide to tie a bundle together, many things do happen. And this is what is going to happen now. And we pray that things will happen for the positive, because none of us, the women, are happy seeing what is happening in our country. No, not at all. We are not happy. Enough is enough.
What are your expectations after this meeting, moving forward, particularly with this ongoing conflict?
My expectations moving forward after the convention is to see that we, the Cameroonian women, spread the women's call for peace to all the corners of the world, to the hallways of institutions such as the African Union, the European Union, and the United Nations, but also to the rural women in every part of the country, those women who have been bearing the brunt of this conflict. We want everyone to join us in our desire to build peace.
Esther Omam Njomo is executive director of the NGO called Women's Empowerment. She spoke with me from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé. Tanzania's government has imposed a ban on public gatherings. The move, health experts say, forms part of the effort to combat the spread of the coronavirus. It comes as Tanzania battles a wave of infections. The ban also comes as Tanzania received over 1 million doses of the Janssen vaccine from the United States. They were donated through the World Health Organization's COVAX vaccine sharing program. Supporters of the government have welcomed the donation, saying, coupled with the ban on public gatherings, it will significantly boost the administration's effort to limit the spread of the disease. Bakret is questioning the timing of the ban, saying the government seeks to prohibit opposition groups from meeting. This, as critics mount an offensive to demand a new constitution. For analysis on the latest political developments following the ban on public gatherings and the donation of coronavirus vaccines, I reach Faraja Lugomi, a lecturer at the University of Dar es Salaam.
Basically, the decision could be very much good as we fight against COVID. But the problem is the timing of the decision. The decision has come at the moment when the main opposition party in our country is conducting the campaign for the new constitution or for the reforms of the constitution. And so they started at the northwestern region of Mwanza, which is southern part of Lake Victoria. And Mwanza is one of the centers of the opposition party in this country. It is one of its centers. So they wanted to introduce the rallies for the movement for the new constitution. And so the government has made the decision that from now on, the public rallies will be banned.
Are people suspicious that perhaps banning of public gatherings is to stop the opposition?
Collect the opinion polls from the public. Roughly, you can say the larger percent are suspicious about the banning because it has come at the time when the ruling party was against the movement to force for the constitutional reforms in our country. So most of the people are indeed suspicious about that.
Some people are suggesting, from the CCM, are suggesting that President Salia Suluhu Hassan has taken a different approach. So the ban is welcome and has rather taken too long in the imposition of this ban.
To be honest, the decision to ban the gatherings in a bid to fight against COVID is the right decision. Politically, we can say that's the right decision. Even professionally or technically, we can say it's the right decision because now the cases, there have been so many new cases of COVID being reported all over the country. Now the problem is, it seems the gatherings that are being targeted by the ban are mostly political gatherings. Yeah, you can see that there is no ban on religious gatherings, there's no ban on social gatherings. Say there are more gatherings in universities, there are more gatherings in churches, in mosques, there are more gatherings in markets, etc. So when you say, okay, we ban only political rallies, that's where people now are questioning. Why only political rallies and not other gatherings?
I understand that the Tanzania government is targeting to vaccinate about 60% of the population. On Saturday, we also understand that the government has received over 1 million doses of the Johnson & Johnson coronavirus vaccine from the United States. How are people reacting to this latest development and news?
So what I've noticed in the public, in the street, is that some people are for it. They have welcomed the decision of the government. Now, the problem is now the vaccination that has come in our country is through the COVAX fund, as I've noted, and it has been supported by U.S. government. And there have been several negotiations with the U.S. government to support on this one, which is a good move. Now, the question is, recently the Minister of Health had announced that there will be six or five types of vaccines that will be given to the population. Now, if the one that has come now will be supplied or will suffice 60% of the population, then people... type of vaccine, where are other types of vaccines? We would expect to see AstraZeneca, would expect to see many several others to be included in the program, but we only see one type of vaccine. So people are questioning, why are we not free to choose even different types of vaccines that people would want to get? Why only this one? Maybe that's the expression of many people whom I happen to talk to.
Faraja Lugome is a lecturer at the University of Dar es Salaam. He spoke with me from the Tanzanian commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs and Music from our African collection. But first, Transparency International Zambia has released its latest report on political campaigns using billboards across the southern African country. It shows that the capital, Lusaka, has the highest number of billboards for presidential candidates in the country's 10 provinces. The findings demonstrate that out of the 674 billboards of presidential candidates in 12 towns, Lusaka accounted for at least 79.5% or 536 billboards, followed by Indola with 38 billboards or 5.6%. The findings also show that the ruling Patriotic Front, or PF, and its presidential candidate, incumbent President Edgar Chagwa Lungu, has the highest number of billboards at 58%. It was followed by the Socialist Party with 18%, while the main opposition United Party for National Development, or UPND Alliance, came in at a distant third with 14%. Maurice Nyambi is the executive director of Transparency International Zambia. He tells me that he hopes the findings will give prospective voters an insight into how much the political parties are spending on billboard advertisements in the run-up to the August 12th presidential and parliamentary elections.
What we started with was just to give an estimate of how much expenditure is going on in terms of advertisement using billboards, because the whole country now has been flooded with all sorts of billboards advertising different political party candidates. And so our focus really was on the billboards that focus on the presidential candidates of the different political parties. We selected six political parties that were in our analysis. And so what we did is that we went to the different advertising agencies that own billboard spaces around Lusaka, but also in 11 other districts across the country. And so we got the prices for the different sizes of billboards, and we were able to then estimate based on that information. So in a nutshell, that is what the research was about.
All right, Maurice, let's look at the main city, the capital, Lusaka. How much money did these political parties pump in?
For Lusaka, the initial analysis that we did, which was a primary survey that we did last month, was just focusing on four political parties, these being the Patriotic Front, then the United Party for National Development, the Socialist Party, as well as the Democratic Party. So these were the four that we initially surveyed in May. And so for the month of June, we decided to still reflect these four political parties for Lusaka only. And what our analysis shows is that the four political parties spent a total of 6,941,000 kwacha, which is just over $310,000 United States dollars on presidential billboard advertising just for the month of June 2021. Now, out of that figure, around 4.4 million of it, which is roughly about to just over 200,000 US dollars, was actually spent by the ruling PF. So they had the majority of the expenditure. I think that is close to 78% of it, so which was spent by the ruling PF, followed by the Socialist Party, and then all the others are down in that order. But I think the interesting thing to note also is that when you compare between the month of May and June, there was quite an exponential increase in terms of the expenditure of political parties on billboard advertisement. There was actually a 46% increment between May and June just on the issue of billboards. And that just gives you an indication of the amounts of money that political parties are spending on trying to get people to actually vote for them in the coming election in 3 weeks.
From your observation, do these political billboards with its associated heavy financial investment translate into actual votes during the election period?
Well, it's very difficult to reach that conclusion, Peter. I recall that in 2011, when the former president Rupia Banda was still in power, during the election for that year, I think the MMD government, which was in power then, I think spent quite extensively on all sorts of advertising, so on billboards, on radio, TV. I mean, they really went flat out. There is a general perception that probably that was one of the most expensive elections that we have ever had in Zambia in terms of how much a particular political party spent. So they really went in heavy with a lot of expenditure on all these campaign activities. But then they still did not win the election because the PF, which was in opposition then, actually swept to victory. And so I don't think that it always translates into actual votes, and it doesn't always give a guarantee that you will actually win the election.
Maurice Nyambi is the Executive Director of Transparency International Zambia. He spoke with me from the Zambian capital, Lusaka. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. The Olympics Tokyo 2020 officially started a year later than planned, and in the midst of a global pandemic, Friday's opening ceremony had no spectators. On Saturday, China won the first gold medal of the Games, and host Japan claimed their first gold. In the women's football competition, Zambia international Barbara Banda became the first African to score a hat-trick at an Olympics women's tournament. On Wednesday, Copa Queens launched their maiden senior international outing on a disappointing note as they were thrashed 10-3 by European champions Netherlands. But on Saturday, Zambia captain Barbara Banda became the first woman to score back-to-back hat-tricks at the same Olympics. In her side's thrilling 4-4 draw with China, Zambia, the only African team competing in women's football, came from 3-1 down to lead 4-3 only for a controversial late penalty denying them a memorable first Group F win. 21-year-old Banda also scored a treble in their 10-3 loss to the Netherlands. Other African teams involved on their first official day of the Games included South Africa's men's hockey team, who were beaten 3-1 by Great Britain. Algeria's Akran Bonabi lost to Japan's Kaito Streets in the men's sabre fencing competition. Meanwhile, Algeria's judo player Fethi Norin was suspended and will be sent home from Tokyo 2020 after he withdrew from the competition to avoid a potential meeting with an Israeli opponent. The 30-year-old Norin was due to face Sudan's Mohamed Abdrasrul in Monday's first round of the men's 73-kilogram class. Victory would have meant he would take on Israel's Toha Bachbul next. But speaking to Algerian TV, he said his political support for the Palestinian cause made it impossible to compete. Norin pulled out of the 2019 World Championships, also in Tokyo, after being paired with Butabul, who has a first round bye. On Saturday, the International Judo Federation said Norin's statement was in total opposition to the governing body's philosophy. Meanwhile, Tunisia's Mohamed Khalil Jendobi won Africa's first medal at the 2020 Olympics when taking silver in the men's taekwondo 58-kilogram category on Saturday. And Kenya's long-distance runner Geoffrey Kamworor has pulled out of the Tokyo Olympics with an ankle injury. Kamworor, who was hoping to win a medal in the men's 10,000 meters, told the media that he was feeling disappointed. the 28-year-old, impressed at the Kenyan Championships last month, running in a time of 27 minutes, 1.06 seconds to secure his Tokyo qualification. It was the fastest time set in Kenya over the distance. A three-time world half-marathon champion, Kamaroro won silver in the 10,000 meters at the World Championships in Beijing in 2015. He's also a former world half-marathon record holder. And in the men's Olympic soccer, 16 nations are vying for Olympic gold. On Thursday, all three of Africa's representatives impressed. Africa is represented by Ivory Coast, Egypt, and South Africa. Ivory Coast beat Saudi Arabia 2-1 in Yokohama. Egypt, without Mohamed Salah, had a goalless draw against Group C favourites Spain. And South Africa lost their opener 1-0 against the hosts in Tokyo. And that's it for this edition of Netherlands Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Even though to the people of Africa and the rest of the international community, the United States has long been hailed as the robust democratic state, a city on an hill that is worthy of emulation, a growing crisis is brewing now in the United States that may well test the veracity of that bold statement. As a result of the 2020 presidential and legislative elections, battle lines are being drawn. While the overwhelming majority of Americans join the Democrats in hailing the victory of the Democratic candidate, President Biden, as the new president, a considerable number of Republicans have joined their leader to say that the election was stolen from them, as they believe that the candidate, Mr. Trump, won an overwhelming victory at the polls. When finally President Biden was inaugurated and the Republicans became concerned that victory at the presidential level in particular might be difficult for them in the future, it seems that they decided to legislate at the state level decisions that will suppress the vote of black and brown people. This has gone a great extent in many of the states being controlled by Republican governors. To counter this move, and or even in anticipation, the Democratic Party in the House of Representatives had passed two legislative drafts, bills that will frustrate what the Republicans were trying to do. One, H.R. 1 and H.R. 4. But the question is, what do you do with the legislations in the Senate? Yes, it has been passed in the House of Representatives, but as the saying goes, bills go to the Senate to die. And the reason why it is so difficult in the Senate is though the two parties have 50 seats and the Democrats have the majority by virtue of the vote of the Vice President of the United States who presides over the Senate, the question of filibustering legislative bills has frustrated the Democrats. Two senators, in particular within the Democratic caucus, have made it clear that they would not join their colleagues in passing legislation to end the filibuster, which not only will facilitate the vote on democracy, but on other major legislation in the Senate. Pressure has been brought to bear on President Biden, who had long been in the Senate, to throw his weight behind those who wants to end the filibuster in the Senate. But nothing has happened. The president last week made a powerful speech in Philadelphia, but did not indicate the process by which the Democrats could end filibuster in the Senate. This has raised deep frustration in the ranks of the Democrats, particularly in the ranks of the progressives, who have been looking forward to President Biden to use the bully pulpit to force this issue of ending the filibuster. It has now come to the awareness of many Democrats, particularly the brown and black members, that the fight for democracy was being left to them alone, and that other Democrats are not showing the same kind of determination to stop what they believe the Republicans are doing. For the Republicans, they believe that what they are doing falls in the category of state rights, and that the federal government had no business interfering with state rights in terms of their legislation on elections. The Democrats show that, yes, the Constitution gives the federal government a right to pass legislation on voting, as they did in 1965 on voting rights. Question now is, what should happen? The fear among many Democrats, and many pundits for that matter, is that if the Republicans succeed in depressing the votes of black and brown people in an area of control, then it's more than likely that the Republicans will take control of the House and the Senate in the midterm, and this will put in doubt the presidential election in 2024. The view of President Biden is that the Democrats can out-campaign the Republicans and produce a surprise win. Few Democrats believe this is a possibility. And there are many Americans who wonder what would happen to the United States if these conditions produce a chance for the defeated candidates of the Republicans who may want to return to the White House in 2024. So the black and brown people are now determined. They believe that they will be the victim should Mr. Trump return to the White House. And they are not prepared to sit idly by without making some moves to stop what the Republicans are doing in the state. And some of them have said their marches and civil disobedience could continue even if it means a confrontation with the leader, President Biden. And if this should happen, this will be a great catastrophe for democracy in the United States. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Nilokutendea Se soubesses abraçar, de vez em quando beijar, e aos recantos imperfeitos, com menos rigor apontar, quem seria eu? Sou órfão da tua ternura. Oh, ei, are, ei, oh, ei, oh, areia, oh, ei, are, ei, oh, ei.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are now on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, editor Bill Eagle, reporter Douglas Impuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, a traveler to distant places should make no enemies. I'm your host, Peter Clotet, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.